The moderates, including Mayor Costa and the director of civic museums, Giandomenico Romanelli, argued that Napoleon and the statue were simply part of Venice's history and therefore worthy of being displayed. The anti-Bonapartists, whose ranks included Count Girolamo Marcello, Count D'Amosto, and most of the center-right, countered that on those grounds one could argue that the bronze bust of Mussolini in storage at the Correr Museum should be displayed as well. The debate rang with endless recitations of Napoleon's thefts, desecrations, and other outrages against Venice. Virtually everyone took one side or the other. Peter and Rose Lauritsen were vocal anti-Bonapartists. I dropped in on a lecture Peter was giving to a group of English students in the Accademia. The first words I heard him say were, "Napoleon saw to the suppression of 40 parishes in Venice and the destruction, razed to the ground, of 176 religious buildings and more than 80 palaces, all of which were decorated with paintings and other works of art. In addition, Napoleon's agents saw to the listing for confiscation of 12,000 paintings, a great many of which were sent to Paris to enrich the collections of something called the Musée Napoléon. I trust if any of you have been to Paris, you have been to the Musée Napoléon. Today, it's rather better known as the Louvre. And of course, it is the single greatest monument to organized theft in the history of art." A poll conducted by the Gazzettino showed the public to be 12-1 against accepting the statue. Nevertheless, Mayor Costa did accept it, and in the dead of night it was smuggled into the Correr Museum, where it was installed in a niche behind a protective shield of plexiglass. Months later, the anti-Bonapartists brought Napoleon before an ad hoc Nuremberg-style tribunal and found him guilty as charged. At the height of the controversy, the leaders of the anti-statue coalition sent two menacing letters to Jerome Zizanus, the head of the French committee, advising him to get out of town. Zizanus expressed his outrage, and city officials hastened to condemn the letter writers. Though tempers had since cooled, the gift of the statue was still widely resented as an insult to Venice. In spite of all that, however, Zizanus had been given two excellent seats at the Fenice's reopening. He was sitting in the orchestra beside the chairman of the World Monuments Fund, Marilyn Perry. The concert opened with Beethoven's Consecration of the House, which was, of course, an apt choice. It put me in mind of the comment Robert Browning made in 1890 to his son, Penn, upon learning that Penn and his rich American wife had bought the enormous Palazzo Rezzonico on the Grand Canal. "Don't be a little man in a big house," Browning warned. Henry James, visiting the Curtises at Palazzo Barbaro a bit further down the Grand Canal, wrote to his sister about the news. "Palazzo Rezzonico is altogether royal and imperial, but Penn isn't kingly, and the train de vie remains to be seen. Gondoliers ushering in friends from pensions won't fill it out." 3 years later, James wrote to Ariana Curtis, "Poor, grotesque little Penn, and poor, sacrificed little Mrs. Penn. There seems but one way to be sane in this queer world, but there are many ways of being mad. And a palazzo madness is almost as alarming, or as convulsive, as an earthquake, which indeed it essentially resembles." Penn Browning had not filled out Palazzo Rezzonico in any memorable way. In fact, it was Robert Browning himself, ironically, who stole the honors from his son by dying in the house and being remembered by a plaque attached to the facade.